Hi, this is David Frangioni, CEO and publisher of Modern Drummer Magazine. So excited about our new podcast, the Modern Drummer Podcast. This weekly podcast will bring Modern Drummer to life. Sit back and enjoy fresh, fun, and insightful conversations with today's top drummers, producers, musicians, beatmakers, and craftsmen. Whether you're a professional, a hobbyist, drummer, musician, programmer, producer, or just love music, this show is for you. Every other week, the Modern Drummer Podcast will feature world-renowned producer, songwriter, and drummer, Narda Michael Walden. Narda Michael Walden's Upbeat is featured exclusively on the Modern Drummer Podcast. Hello, everybody. I'm David Frangioni. I'm here with Billy Amendola. And on this week's podcast, we have the one and only Mickey Curry. Welcome, Mickey.
Hey.
Yeah.
Hey, man. Hi.
Welcome. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, you guys. This is great. It's exciting.
I know you guys have crossed paths before because David has worked on some of Brian's albums.
Right.
So yep, no, Mickey and I go way back. The first time we met was, I want to say it was on the So Far So Good tour, I think.
Right.
And, you know, I was traveling with Brian on a bunch of dates. And yep. And then from there, yeah, I mean, that was the 90s, yep. Right? So that's yep. Like 25 years ago, at
112
least.
112 years ago.
And I have to say, now, of course, I had heard you play quite a bit prior to meeting you in person. But because I was with Brian and hanging a lot, I would stand in the front row.
Yeah.
At a bunch of shows, a lot of shows actually. And so watching you that closely and hearing the combination of stage sound and front of house and watching the communication of the band on stage, it was awesome. I mean, to me, it was really, Mickey, the definition of when you think of an awesome rock pop drummer that glues the band together. It's always playing something interesting, but the music is still like forging forward, has just this great driving, you know, groove all the time. I learned so much.
You know, it's funny because I've had the experience of sitting on the side of the stage many times with Mickey. Back in the day, we even played together. I don't know if you remembered, we went to that Yamaha thing one time. We actually played drum. I think you were one of the first, like, really like pro guys that I played along with next to, and I was like so nervous that day. And
that's,
I was like,
so funny. Pro, yeah. But you mean pro meaning somebody pays you to play drums? Is that the difference between?
Yeah, no, somebody that I like really, really looked up to.
Yeah.
But nice. But and that, oh my God, that was, yeah, that was in the 80s sometimes. But yeah. I was gonna say, sitting on the side of stage last year, I didn't are you sitting lower now than you even used to? Because I couldn't believe how low. Yeah.
It might be a bit lower than it used to be. I've always sat low since, you know, like club band days in the 70s here in Connecticut. I was in a car accident when I was 21 and I hurt my back, my lower back. And, you know, I was sort of took care of it for a couple of months. And then when I got back on the drum kit, I couldn't sit the way I normally sat. You know, I sort of sat about as high as everybody else. I don't know how high it was, but I tried sitting up higher, you know, like the Ringo thing, and that hurt even more. So the lower I went and the further back from the kit I got, I could sort of arch my lower back, you know, and that seemed to work. So I just worked out how to set up, you know, keep everything in front of me. You know, it worked out that way. So I've always sat really low. And yeah, I think.
And you have such a relaxed, I mean, I was watching you from the side. You have such a, you're rocking. And, you know, and Brian has so many soft love ballads, you know.
Yeah.
But live, the band, I mean, the band rocks, and you just comfortably, right? Like David said, yeah. Locking it, putting the glue, like locking it right in, and yeah. So comfortable. But I noticed that you were sitting a little bit lower.
I sit about as low as a matter of fact, Yamaha is the only stool I can use, the old Yamaha thrones, because they go really low.
Yeah, a lot of schools don't.
You know, I've got a couple of, you know, after guys, there's some of the newer ones. I can't use them. I have to use the old thrones, you know.
Do you use a back?
No.
Do you use a back? No, open back.
They're just the big padded, you know, seat, round padded seats. And, you know, we get them recovered every once in a while. And just I've been using the same ones for years. So.
And you went back to arenas. Brian, as you know, did a bunch of acoustic dates for a while. Right. But then the band's back the last few years pre-COVID. And you guys are doing big places again and the whole band.
Yeah, we were in Scandinavia beginning of March. End of February into March, we had about a 3-week run. We were going to go through, you know, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Finland. We got 3 or 4, maybe 5 shows in, and this thing hit pretty hard. So everybody, we got on a plane and came home. So I was home that first week of March, 10th, I think it was. And, you know, they shut down all the airports a few days later, and nobody was going anywhere. So I'm glad I got home, or I'd still be in Oslo right now. You know, I mean, there was no way out of the thing. So everything's on hold, and we'll see what happens next year, you know. So we've been doing lots of big shows. So
I want to go back for in case people have been living under a rock, and I know you're kind of a private person, so you don't do tons and tons of interviews. So thank you for doing this today with us.
No, thanks for having me. This is great.
I want to go back, and I don't think that there's anybody else. I can't think of anyone else in the business who has toured and recorded for 2 major superstar groups, Hall & Oates and Bryan Adams, which Bryan Adams even still to this day. I don't think there's anybody else.
Well, I'm really lucky, you know. I mean, the Hall & Oates thing was such a great time. And, you know, if we weren't on the road, we were in the studio. So I got to do 3 or 4 albums with them, 6 or 7 years. And then I was working with Brian through that whole period. I was with Daryl and John. We'd have a couple of weeks off. I'd go in the studio with Brian, and we got a lot of recording done, you know, from his early records. So I've been working with him for a long time. Just I couldn't go on the road because I was touring with Daryl and John, and I couldn't split up the stuff. So 87, Daryl went solo, did a solo record, and was going to do some solo stuff. So, you know, I needed to work. And I had gone up to Vancouver. I was working on the Into the Fire record, and they asked me to come on the road. So, you know, the rest.
And those Hall & Oates, the Hall & Oates days, that was like MTV's peak. So. Yeah. You were on those records and on MTV.
We were on MTV all the time. I know the videos used to drive us crazy because they would book like 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks. And we would have to go into this kind of movie studio and shoot all these videos for all the singles, you know. And back then, you know, one video could take, 5 or 6 days to shoot get all the shots. It was horrible. So, you know, we spent a lot of time working on videos, and that they were a big part of Daryl and John's success. You know, they made great videos,
they've always had studio musicians up until that point, and then you were on all those records. And then same thing with Brian. Brian is a singer-songwriter. He could have had, you know, studio musicians and you played on all of that stuff. So had so many songs on the radio at one time that you were a studio musician, even though you were a live guy. Another person that I can't think of anybody who's done that.
It's funny because, you know, from the time I was a kid, you know, I was a little kid, I wanted to do session work because I wanted to play everything. I wanted to play all different kinds of stuff. I couldn't just sort of, you know, play the rock thing. I didn't want to just play R&B. I wanted to play everything. So, you know, I would listen to all these great studio musicians, you know, find records with Bernard Purdy and Jeff Porcaro and Jim Keltner and, you know, Steve Gadd, and you name all of the great, your favorite guys. You know?
Right.
So I thought what a great way to make a living. You know, you go into a recording studio, you get to play drums on all these different types of songs, different musicians, and what a great way to make a living. It'd be great. So I was lucky, you know, I got to do that. And at the same time, you know, your bread and butter is going out and playing live. So you got to do that as well. So I've been really lucky, you know, just lucky. Between
When you started with Brian in 87, as Hall & Oates was you know, the solo album was happening, other stuff.
Yeah.
From then on, you've toured all of it from then on with Brian.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, and except for the bare bones stuff that you mentioned, but yes, we've been touring
because there wasn't a drummer.
No.
Yeah.
And you know, we've been touring forever. And luckily, you know, when we weren't on the road, I would get to, you know, I was in LA a lot. I'd worked on a lot of records all through the 80s and 90s. And
I have to tell you, Mickey, and this is very old news to you, but I remember talking to Brian, because Brian never really looked at me from a drum standpoint.
Yeah.
All the technology.
Yeah.
And
yeah, of course.
We weren't really talking about drums that much, but when I had an opportunity to talk drums with him and he kind of looked at me through a different view for a minute,
yeah,
he would just always talk about just that undeniable, unique groove that you brought that he just saw as like, just to your credit, just this one of a kind, you know, approach to how you played and drove the band. And it got me thinking, because I respect Brian so much, it got me thinking like from another view as well, like, okay, let me really understand, let me go deep on like what, because I've been a musician my whole life, so it's like, sure, let me really understand what is Brian referring to, and I would really analyze listening to you play, and it's just what is your approach that you're able to have this combination that so few drummers are ever able to accomplish, where you can drive the band, but it's not in any way just like so simple that it lacks imagination and nuance. It has all that stuff, but yet what you feel in the audience is just energy.
Yeah.
And it's not all this, you know, fills and drumistic stuff, yet you try to play what you play and you realize, I don't know how he does it. What
you know that answer? I'll let Mickey tell it, but I know.
Well, you know, I am really technically, I'm really kind of limited. Okay, I cannot even imagine how Dave Weckl does what he does. Okay, but or all those great guys. You know, Steve Gadd's that guy. You know, he takes what he knows and he just blends it into a song or a track, and it's magical. But no, for me, it's got to feel right. Just sit down and play. Keep it simple. Keep the time. You know, make sure your backbeat is where it needs to be. It's just got to feel like something. It has to groove. It has to feel right. It can't just be a part. And if you're feeling it, the bass player is going to be feeling it, and the guitar player is going to be feeling it, and the keyboard player is going to be feeling it, and especially the guy singing the song is going to feel it. So, you know, it's all about feel, what it feels like. You know, and if I'm feeling it, it's definitely going to make everybody else feel the same thing.
And to get to that point where you can play what you feel.
Yeah.
Was it just playing?
I think it's just, you have to play a lot. You have to, you know, focus on that and concentrate on it. And also, you know, I've always just stolen little bits and pieces from all my favorite guys. You know, Bernard Purdy is the master, of that, you know, Jeff Porcaro, just anything he ever played. There's not a bad note in any of those tracks. So these are the guys, you listen to these guys and you sort of try to pull, technically you pull what they're playing and sort of try to bring it into your little bag of tricks, you know, your little thing. So, it for me, it's always been that. You just take the notes that you're comfortable playing, you know, that you're comfortable with. Don't try to overplay or you know, you don't have to play everything you know in every song. You know,
well, the fact that you brought up some of those guys and said that you were into studio musicians, I think that's the key right there, because you grew up listening to songs.
Yeah, songs. It's all about songs. And you know,
and
I've always
huge fans of Ringo, even though everybody talks about Ringo all the time, but I know that you're like me and so many other people are such a huge fan of Ringo. So you don't need all those chops, because you may not have got the work that you got if you had all those chops, because you might have got fired from somebody saying, hey, please. No, you know, the late Tony Thompson, he used to say to me all the time when he first got into Chic, you know, Nile Rodgers, he came in, he was into Billy Cobham, he was studying with Nada Michael Walden, and then he came in to play Chic stuff, which was going to be a disco band.
Right.
And Nile looked at Bernard at one time and said, I don't, because Bernard brought him in, he said, I, what is it with this guy? Why does he need all these cymbals and all these drums? And one by one, they started taking his
taking things away. Left him with a kick and a snare and a hi-hat. But nobody could play a kick and a snare and a hi-hat like Tony.
Well, he learned. But you see, you grew up. Yeah. You grew up learning about playing to song. Yeah.
I mean, listen to any Motown track, right? All those guys, Benny Benjamin and Pistol Allen and Uriel Jones. And, you know, even the earlier things, like Marvin Gaye played on a bunch of early Motown records. And his drumming is just phenomenal. But it's all about groove and feel. You know, just getting a good, get that backbeat where it's supposed to be, you know, and just make it feel good.
And you practice with the click a lot?
No, but, you know, just from being in the studio so much, especially when I was younger, you just get, you have to learn to play with a click. I mean, you have to, you know, and it was always for me, you know, my biggest fear was always, you know, don't lose the click. So that was a big joke too. And especially on all those early Adams records, you know, it cuts the, all those, I remember a song called Fits You Good on the You Want It, You Got It record. And I remember tracking that song and I'm just beating my brains out. You know, I'm pounding, I'm playing as hard and as much, it just big, big drums. And I kept just, I was focusing, just don't lose the click. You're going to sound like an idiot. So,
it was. Well, and also the Hall & Oates, that Jimmy Brailauer programming, a lot of the, and then Arthur Baker doing the remixes. So
yeah, a lot of that.
That was the sound that just started to come in. So you kind of had to play.
Yeah,
sound like a machine.
Yeah, a lot of those records, I didn't know whether to sort of run away or get involved. So Jimmy he's a great guy, Jimmy Brailauer, and we worked a lot on just getting those little drum grooves the way Daryl needed them for those songs. But I really dug doing that, you know, working in the electronics with live drums, you know, and Bob Clearmountain was really crucial in getting that to happen. So, we spent some time just putting live drums over those great little parts or we'd loop, you know, we'd do a drum thing. I'd play, you know, 8 bars of something and they could just loop it.
Right.
And stuff on top of, you know, clean it up But Clearmountain was crucial to that, the success of those tracks, you know.
Well, Clearmountain produced the Bryan Adams record, and then you also worked with him on other records.
Yeah, I had the first thing I did with Bob Clearmountain was I did G.E. Smith's record at Power Station. It was amazing. It was the first place I worked in New York City was Power Station.
Wow.
And then, you know, and then we were at Electric Lady a month later working with Daryl and John and then back a couple of weeks later with Brian at Power Station. So I was in two great studios in my first couple of New York studio experiences.
And what was it like working with Bob? I mean, he's such a legendary figure, but that was really what his heyday in producing and working so close with the tracks.
I've always said, I wouldn't have had half the career I have had if it wasn't for Bob Clearmountain. He could make the drums sound, so big and good and great. He loved how I played and he could mix how I played. You know, it was his sort of idea of a good drum track was me playing and him mixing it. So the combination of, you know, the two of
them. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, those big, all the big tom fills and all those big floor tommy things. And, you know, he was really, and that snare drum sound, you know, that Clearmountain snare drum, man, it's just,
and were you using the same snare?
We used a couple
on all
of
the records, and
we
then
used
he
a couple of different
it?
Snare drums.
Different ones.
Black Beauty on a lot of that stuff. And I had I've always been a fan of the Yamaha, the 7-inch Birch shell snare drums. Those I have 2 or 3 of those that were on a lot of those records as well. And Bob liked that sound too. Bob used to tune the snare drum. I'd come into the I'd walk into a session, you know, a half an hour early just to get the drums together, and he'd be sitting at the drum kit tuning the snare drum. You know? He knew it was funny. There was a certain rattle and a certain sort of overtone that he needed to have in order to set the gates properly on the, you know, SSL. And he really had his thing for how to get that snare drum sound. So that was, that was always fun. But Bob's great. And
he's one of the best. Great, no doubt
great
about
ears.
That.
He knows how to mix a song.
And you've been with Yamaha now. How many years you've been with Yamaha?
Since 1981. So
wow,
yeah, I don't know what that is. I'm 112. I don't know. I know.
Sometimes I feel like I'm 120.
Yeah, but you only look.
And then sometimes I feel like I'm 12. So you know.
Well, you're probably like me. You know, most guys. You know, you get to this age and you still think you're 35 years old in your head. you go for it like you're a kid. So. It's like I'm talking about 35 like they're kids. But.
Well, they are, really. Yeah. Music keeps you young.
It does. I think so. I think it does.
Yeah. Talking about producers, I heard a track the other day because I was just listening to some. I told Alexa to shuffle some Bryan Adams, and I forgot the name of the song, but it was a tune I wasn't that familiar with, and it sounded – I told my wife it was Def Leppard. Oh. And then when I looked at the credits, I saw it was co-written by Mutt Lange and Bryan, and of course produced. Now, what did you learn from working with Mutt?
I love Mutt. Mutt's great. You know, I heard horror stories about working with Mutt, drummers go, apparently, because he's really, you know, he hones in on what he needs to hear, and he knows exactly what he's got to have. He knows it when he hears it, you know? So,
And he programs a lot of.
And
what
he programs
wants.
A lot of that stuff's all you know programmed. So I was a little leery about working with him because I had heard it takes. Somebody told me it took him a week to get a hi-hat track, you know. So I thought, oh, this is not going to go well because I just sort of sit down and play and hopefully it works. You know, I'm not really a piece it together kind of guy. So, but I got in the studio with Mutt and he loved everything. He just loved everything. He kept first or second take of most things I recorded with him. The song "Have You Ever Really Loved a Woman" was recorded in Jamaica at a house in Jamaica.
I was there.
You were there.
Yeah, in Ocho Rios.
That's right.
Yeah, with the rig that we did with Ron Obvious.
Of course, you were there. Well, do you remember we had the drums upstairs? And Paco de Lucia had just spent 3 days putting guitars on the song.
And they tracked him down because he was on vacation there and they were looking for him and he was like next door.
So he was in hell because, you know, he thought he would be done in an hour or two, put a couple of guitar tracks on. He ended up putting about 30 guitar tracks on the thing and it took him 3 days. But it worked out for me because I got to sit outside at the pool and listen to the song
in the ocean
1,000 times. You know, to get it in my head to know what I was doing. So anyway, you know, I got upstairs. The control room was downstairs. We had cameras so we could see each other.
Yep.
And okay, roll the tape. So they roll and I record and I finish and it's quiet for like what seemed like, you know, 10 minutes. It was really probably 10 seconds, but nobody said anything. And Mutt came on the talkback and said, he goes, "Yeah, Mickey, man, I think you got it." So I thought, okay, this is a joke. Okay, all right, I'll do it again. And he goes, "No, man, I think you got it." So what? So I went downstairs and we listened and it was done, except for he needed a fill somewhere. Put a fill right here. So I went back upstairs and I did a little, you know, Benny Benjamin fill, which as is my custom, and it worked. So I was thrilled to death to be able to get a track in one take with Mutt Lange and, you know, have it work. And
that's great.
It worked out really well. So I was happy for that. But I love working with Mutt. He's great, you know?
Yeah.
And he's a really good guy and he's funny.
He created a sound.
He's amazing. He we did a session in Paris where we did two songs in start to finish. Recorded, mixed, and done in one day. And that was the whole gist of the session. And it worked out great with Mutt. We had 12 guys in the room, you know, 3 guitars, 2 keyboard players. It was really a busy session. And worked out great. So Mutt's a great guy to work with.
Talking about, you just gave me a flashback. The three of us are pretty much around the same age. David's younger than us, but he remembers these days when you used to be in the studio and you were in this either own room by yourself and everybody else was on the other side behind the glass. You didn't know if they were liking what you were doing.
No.
The main thing was to never look in there, because half of the time, if they weren't paying attention, you're like, oh, they're not digging what I'm doing. And then, or they turn around after you finish and they go, got it. And you'd be like, really? I didn't even think anybody was paying attention.
Yeah. Well, that was a big joke with Bob Clearmountain, because if I looked in the control room and he was standing, if he was on his feet looking over the board at me, I knew it was a good take. If he was still sitting and just sort of, you know, playing with the board, we probably had some work to do. But he always sort of clued me in. He would stand up and really get excited, you know, when he was listening to something. So he knew what he was listening to. But I hated that. I hated being behind all the big baffles.
I know.
And, you know, you're really isolated, and that was never any fun. But we did get to a point somewhere in the 90s where
open drums,
man, just, you know, big mics all over the room, and you know, drums.
So let's touch a little bit, because there was a couple of records. I know you did the Cult record. You did a Cult album, right? Sonic.
Two albums, yeah.
From in 92 to 93, right?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, I did Sonic Temple.
Sonic Temple, that's the one.
And Ceremony, the follow-up record.
Yes.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
I had done some work with Bob Rock, you know, in Vancouver.
Another great one.
Yeah, great producer and a great guy and a really talented musician as well. And really fun to work with. Bob Rock's one of those guys you just... Whatever you play, he loves. You know, he just...
And he always got...
Play great,
always,
and I'll love it. So,
and he always got good... He's another one that always got...
Great drum sounds.
Great drum sounds.
Great drum sounds. He really hones in on that. And he's a master. You know, he's another guy. He's just got great ears, you know. The Cult record, Bob asked me if I would be interested in coming up to Vancouver and working on a Cult record. And I thought, great, I would love to. You know, I had been a fan of theirs. And I thought this will be fun. So I went up, we rehearsed for a few days, and then we did all the tracks. We were done, I think, in about a week on the Sonic Temple record. And, you know, Fire Woman turned out to be a big hit for them. So,
And did you tour with them as well?
No, I never toured with them. They were hoping I could go do some shows with them, but I couldn't. When we did the follow-up record, I actually went with them. To a couple of auditions. They were looking for a drummer. So we would record during the day, and then at night they were going to a rehearsal place and listening to drummers. And the first night I went, Matt Sorum was auditioning, and he played about, I don't know, he played about 30 seconds. And I just looked at them both and said, you guys are nuts if you don't hire this guy. He's the best drummer I've ever heard. He was unbelievable, and he's such a sweet guy. He's a really good guy, and they hired him on the spot, so I'm glad for that, because Matt's a great drummer, and he worked out really good for those guys.
You know? Yeah, that was cool.
He went on to do the Guns N' Roses thing.
So. Yeah, no, Matt's cool.
Yeah, but no, that whole connection with the Cult was Bob Rock.
And, so what's the matter? You couldn't do three tours and three albums?
Yeah. Yeah. I know. I think back, I don't know how it all worked out, but it just worked out. You know, if I wasn't on the road, I was lucky enough to be in a studio for a few days here and there, you know, I could fly.
Yeah. Because
I could work in New York.
Yeah. And then there was, I saw Carly Simon. You did two Carly Simon records.
I only did one record. I did, Let the River Run, the song from Working Girl.
Wow.
Yeah. I got to play on that. And then they asked me to do the video. So I had to go into Manhattan at 4:30 in the morning and it was the middle of February and they were shooting on the Staten Island ferry. And at 6:30 or 7 o'clock in the morning, when the ferries are running, they set up the drum kit on the very back part of the deck of the ship.
Oh my God.
Of the boat, you know, the thing, the ferry, and the wind, it had to be 10 below zero. And I'm trying to lip sync this really goofy sort of tom-tom part on that song. And anyway, we spent the day on the Staten Island Ferry shooting the video.
But that's great.
Brian wrote a song for Carly. And we recorded that as well. I don't know when that was. So it was around right around the same time. So,
wow. Yeah, because there was a couple of people like Cher. I didn't know you played with Cher.
Yeah, we did two songs. Bruce Fairburn, who was a great producer in Vancouver, had asked Keith Scott and I if we'd be interested in doing a couple of tracks. So we did a couple of songs for a Cher record. Yeah, that was fun. But yeah, wow. a lot of those things, those names, you know, I only did a couple of songs. Celine Dion, I only did a couple of songs for. And I wanted to talk to Kenny about that because he was working on that record with who was producing that record? Anyway, and he had to go. It was running into some other session he had. So they called me and asked me if I'd come into New York and work on a couple of tracks. So I did. Jim Steinman was producing. And I wanted to talk to Kenny about that because I remember talking to him on the phone.
And this is, we're talking about Cher?
And Celine Dion record.
Celine Dion.
Yeah.
Wow, Jim did Celine Dion. I didn't know that.
I think a lot of those records were different producers would put together songs. And, you know, if they were liked, then they got put on the album.
It's all coming back to me now,
I think that was that was the record, yeah. But I did the Ike and Tina song, River Deep, Mountain High. We did a version of that.
Wow.
Yeah. Chasm Sultan was in on that session. That was really good. So
when things get back to normal a little bit, Mickey, what's next? Back out with Brian?
I don't know. Yeah, maybe. We're going to see what happens when the new year comes around and, you know, just how long it's going to take for all of this to go away or to get back to something. But yeah, I'm, you know, looking forward to working. Just, I don't know what that means or what it will entail, but I'm sure Brian's got, things going on. He's probably, ready to go. So, we'll see, just take it day by day and hope we can all get back.
I know.
I'm dying to get back in the studio. I've done a few things earlier this year out here in Connecticut. There's a little studio I go in and put drums on stuff for guys, and that's been really fun. You know, it brings me back to that.
Oh, that's awesome. What studio are you working out of?
It's a place called Horizon Music. It's in West Haven out here in Connecticut, and Vic Steffens, who is a good friend and a great drummer as well, he runs the place, and he's got drum kits and everything all set up, and I drive over. It's a 20-minute drive, and I just walk in, and we just spend all day playing drums, and it's so much fun.
But oh, that's awesome.
You just do it now, you know? You can't. It's like, well, who was touching the doorknobs, and who was in
the
TV?
It's scary.
So hopefully, you know, to be honest, you guys, I love being home. You know, I'm home. It's not that guys go, well, I'm stuck home. I can't do it. I love being home.
Do you have a kit there and a studio
I have
setup?
I have an old Gretsch kit. It's the first kit I ever had. My father bought me when I was 11. And I've got it down in my basement. So it's between the furnace and the pile of paint cans and the oil tank. It's over there in the corner, and it's piled up with all kinds of junk. But every once in a while, you know, if I get the urge, I can go down and put on some Marvin Gaye and blast along.
Love it.
Kind of like being reborn again, going back to your childhood. Right?
Yeah. Well, you know what? I think that don't we all do that? Or you have to do that, right?
You've got to do it once in a while.
It's a rebirth all the time, right?
Yep.
You sort of refresh.
Yeah.
You hit the refresh button and just go back.
Things will get better. They will.
Yeah. I hope so. I'm pretty sure.
Two last things before we go. Live Aid. How was it playing at Live Aid?
Live Aid was great. We were kind of the house band there.
Yeah. Right?
Because we did some Hall & Oates stuff. Then Eddie Kendrick and David Ruffin came out. And we did some Temptations medley things. And then Mick Jagger came out. We did one of his things. And then Tina came out and we did a thing with Mick and Tina. It was exciting. You know, we had rehearsed the day before for up at SIR in New York, and Mick was unbelievable, man. such a professional, you know. He knew, he's amazing. He knew every part that everyone was doing, right? He was so aware of, he makes it look like he's just winging it. Like it's just, he's just making it up as he goes. But he is so aware of every single little nuance of the music and the choreography and what's going on stage. And
how did it come up that you were the house band for all these different artists? Like,
I don't know. I think they must've, you know, had meetings between the big wigs, you know, Daryl and John must've talked to Mick and Mick must've talked to Tina and, you know, Eddie and David, we had done the thing at the Apollo.
Right. Theater, yeah.
And it was really
great.
Fun. So
that was
thought,
great.
Let's bring that. We'll bring that to Live Aid, you know, so.
Oh, okay. And then the other, and then it just started to grow from there.
Yeah, it just grew from there, right? Like, okay, so this will be a great hour on stage. Like, you know, you have all these, you know, mixed teams. Unbelievable. It was so exciting, you know.
And being back there, I'm
slamming my brains out back there, you know, just trying to, you know, you're so jacked up about doing the show. And, you know, T-Bone, God bless him. I miss him a lot. Anyway, he was, you know, he's sort of musical director on the whole thing. So he was sort of conducting and, you know, we had the horns and it was really fun. It was really
fun. That was great.
Bashiri Johnson was up there.
Bashiri was playing percussion. Ah, I love Bashiri.
Oh, wow. I love Bash, man. He's
Me too. Bash
is awesome. I think any studio thing that I did drums on, Bashiri's was on percussion.
There were two guys for me the whole time, like all those New York things. It was Bash and Jimmy Malin. Jimmy Malin is just absolutely a gem. We did a Live at Liberty Park show. Hall & Oates did. It was a big live thing, and they did some HBO thing with it later. But it was the last time I got to work with Jimmy, and he was fantastic, man. Now, that Avalon record is some of the best percussion and drumming stuff ever.
And Ralph McDonald at one time.
Ralph McDonald, another great, yeah.
And when I used to love when you used to do the groove night, used to hang in at NAMM and go to parties and that's when we were talking about going back out on the road and everything and we can't be near each other. Live Aid popped in. That's why Live Aid popped into my head.
Yeah, can you imagine? Right, 100,000 people in
one of the largest crowds ever, and it's televised to millions and millions of people.
Yeah, something like 3.5 billion people saw that.
Yeah,
and. You know, between the London show, you know, at Wembley, that giant, you know, 85,000 or 90,000 people in that stadium, and then where we were at RFK there, it was nuts, man. That was
I can imagine.
And there were so many great people. That Brian was there. I saw him. I saw him in the food tent that day.
You didn't play with him at Live Aid.
I didn't get to play with Brian at Live Aid. It was Pat Stewart was playing. The great Pat Stewart. So
okay, right, because that would have been 87 on is when the run has started and is not ending. But at that period, you were still
I was still doing the Hall & Oates live stuff. Yeah, and we were sort of winding down then. But that was a busy summer.
Yeah, that was cool. Man. Well, one last thing before we go.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about why you started playing drums when you saw the Beatles, all of us, and a little bit about Ringo.
Well, Ringo's the guy. You know, I was living at my grandmother's house. I was 7 years old. And my brothers and I, you know, I have four older brothers and two younger brothers. Anyway, we're all excited. The Beatles are going to be on Ed Sullivan show. And, you know, you've been hearing them on the radio and you were like, couldn't wait to see this. And my grandmother wouldn't let us watch. There's no way you guys are looking at these, you know, mop top, you know, long hair, whatever, hippie.
They're going to ruin America.
Yeah, they're just going to destroy you. So this is really the truth. Our bedroom door, the room we were sleeping, we all had bunk beds in this one room, and it was onto the living room, and I could just, if you crack the door just right, you could just see the TV. So we were like, you know, like that cartoon where the mice all stand on top of each other and they're looking out the keyhole. We watched, and I was in awe of Ringo. I just couldn't, something hit me, man. I was, you know, just, it hit me. That is something I know, you know, do. So from that age on, I was really smitten, you know, and the Beatles did it. And Ringo is the guy. He's always.
I know.
Well, you weren't playing drums at that point, right?
No, I wasn't. I was seven, and I didn't really start. I didn't pick up a pair of sticks and actually bang on a drum till I was 10 years old. So, but there was something about that, you know.
That's when your dad got you the Gretsch kit?
Yeah. Yeah. I was 11 when he gave me that.
Amazing. Yeah. And you still have it.
I do. Yeah, I have it. You know, it's a beautiful kit. It's a mid 50s. I think it's like 53.
The old badge, the round. Yeah.
The old round badge. And it's those beautiful maple shells. And, It was that white satin swirl, you know, that was, it's called Satin Swirl. It looked like
Have you ever recorded? I don't want to.
Yeah, that kid I've recorded with way back.
Right.
Yeah. When I was 15, I got my first sort of recording gig at a studio in Connecticut. I went and did a bank commercial for like $25. And we threw the drums in my mother's car and she drove me up to the studio and, you know, we said, but that was the kit I used on that. And yeah, I had done a few recordings with that, with various bands. And you know.
And I always used to go to sessions and, you know, I won't say who or what, but whoever you were endorsing, they're just, when it came to recording, everybody used Gretsch. I kept saying, I didn't know, you know, at the time I was just I was looking around and I was like, wow, it's either a Ludwig kit or a Gretsch kit.
Yeah.
I thought you play X kit.
I thought you were a Rogers guy.
Yeah. Don't tell anybody.
Yeah. I know. I've heard that about a lot of great drummers. Like, well, I won't mention any names, but it was always, you know, when the tape's rolling, the Gretsch kit's the one on the floor. So.
Yeah. Yeah. something to be said for that.
Yeah. But they were always the kid. Gretsch and Ludwig and maybe Slingerlin to a certain extent. A lot of guys played Slingerlin. So Danny Seraph played Slingerlin.
Right. I know he was another big influence on you.
Oh, huge. Huge.
Danny Seraphine?
Yeah. He still is. You know, he's one of my heroes. He taught me how to play. You know, I was a kid and listening to those first three or four Chicago records. The drumming on those records is just phenomenal.
Yeah.
He was a kid. Apparently he was 19 years old on that first record.
I know. When Buddy Rich said, when they asked him who in Modern Drummer, they asked him who he liked. And he said, I like Steve Gadd and I like that kid that's in that band, Chicago.
And Buddy Rich does not like anybody. He didn't like anybody. Yeah. Did he?
Yeah. Well, they weren't really a rock band. He wasn't.
No. It's funny. Rock. You know, you see some of the footage of Buddy now. You see these secret shows and these, you know, private film footage. Some of these home movie things. Just unbelievable, man.
One of a kind.
One of a kind. He's got a great. Did you ever read his book? It's called Traps.
The one. Mel Torme.
Yeah. Who was also a great musician.
And Mickey, on your Yamaha kit, what's your Yamaha kit of choice? What's your go-to? Which series and what?
I like the vintage Maple Customs. Is my sort of choice. I've been using the new hybrid Maples, and I really like them. But just for, you know, sort of what sort of, you know, gets me in the heart, I would have to say the vintage Maple Custom kit. You know, they kind of remind me of the old Gretsch shells, and you know, they.
And what sizes do you use?
Right now, I've got 12-inch rack, 14-16 floors, and a 24-inch kick drum, and I'm using one of my old 7-inch Birch shell snare drums.
And what cymbals?
Well, I'm a Zildjian guy, so I've got a 21-inch Sweet Ride, a couple of Ks, 17, 18 Ks, and I've got a 19-inch Rivets. It's an old A that we made in old Rivets. And I've always used 15-inch New Beats.
Oh, 15s.
Always 15s.
And it's just straight new beats, top and bottom.
Yeah, top and bottom. Well, the bottom's a little heavier, you know, than the top. But
right. But that's standard new beat.
Yeah, that's it for me, man. I just I love them.
And the K's cut because you're playing.
Yeah.
Even though you know it's live, it's mic'd, but it's still.
I find that the
stage volume.
The 17 and 18 inch K's actually sound pretty good. You know, they sound pretty good, and it depends on how you hit them too. You know, you can hit them. So that they're really subtle, you know, the decay is there's no attack. It's just a lot of wash and decay. Or you can really smack them, you know, like an A custom. You know, I like an A customs too. I'll slot those in once in a while, a 17 and 18.
And that's the trick to the case.
Yeah, I think it's how you hit a K symbol is really, you know, the thing. I'm not a big fan. I've tried K hi-hats and ride cymbals, but I love that 21-inch sweet ride. That's a great cymbal. It's a great cymbal. It's got a nice big bell, so you can really get a honk on there, you know, when you
want. And enough definition. And
it yeah, it's got definition when you need it, but it's also got that Ringo wash, you know, that wash when you want. And I love that. I go for that all the time now live, you know.
Wow, that's awesome. Yeah, that's pretty hard to find. Usually they're either real pingy or real washy.
Yeah, well, he used small cymbals, right? I think he had an 18 and a 19 or something, right? Isn't that what, I'm not sure. Maybe a 20 inch, but I don't think he used 20s. I think he used small cymbals. And he had a rivets for a while too, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Everybody played rivets, you know, everybody's, how do they get that sound? You know, like how did Mitch Mitchell get that great wash, you know? And it was probably a rivet cymbal.
And so you have an A with rivets?
Yeah, I have an A. It's a 19-inch, and that's got rivets. I use different rivets, but that's the one I go to. I keep it over there on the just over the 16, so when I'm lost down there, I got somewhere to go. You know? It's really close.
Love it.
Yeah, because you don't want to get lost down there. Once you're over there and you forget it, the whole thing goes. So,
well. Thank you. I want to thank you so much. I mean, I know we could stay on. Yeah. We're going to have you on. We'll have you on again.
Let's do that. I would love to do it again, man. It's really fun. And you know how much I love talking to you, Billy. Every time I see you, it's hours of we could just yap for hours. So
yeah, well, so much to learn. So much to learn from your experience, Mickey. Thanks, thank man. You for being
David, it's great to see you again, drummer. Man. It's been a long time, you know.
It has been a while. Yeah. It has. It's yeah. great to see you as well.
And good. I'm glad things are good and thanks for just all the modern drummer stuff, man. You guys have been really good to me always, and I appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you so much. My love to Susan. I love you.
Thanks. I'll talk to you.
We'll talk soon.
Thank you, Mickey Curry. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Okay, it's time for the Shop Talk section of the episode. This is Mike Dawson, Managing Editor at Modern Drummer, and this week I'm chatting with my good friend Steven Stetcher over at Doc Sweeney Drums. They sent two snare drums for us to review. One is a 6.5x14 8-lug East Indian Rosewood solid shell drum. They're calling the Vishuddha. Gorgeous drum. The other one is a 5.5x14 8-lug Tasmanian Blackwood with a solid shell, and they're calling that the TB1. These are amazing drums, so we're going to drop in some demos of both of these drums later. But first, we're going to just chat with Steve about the company, the concept of how they make drums, and then a little bit of background on these two particular drums, and then we'll check them out. All right, let's get to it. Doc Sweeney Drums.
Well, who is Doc Sweeney?
Doc Sweeney is my best friend. We grew up together, played drums together. He went off and became an educator, and when I built the company, was trying to come up with some catchy name, and I thought, well, Doc Sweeney sounds pretty cool. So the named it after my best friend.
Nice. So how did you get into building drums?
When I retired from the corporate world, I had been a drummer all throughout those years, and when I decided to retire early, I was looking for a hobby and just started, you know, spending more time playing drums, checking out all kinds of different equipment. And just one thing led to another, decided, you know, let me do some research and figure out what it takes to make a drum. And that led to one, which led to more, one for Doc, as a matter of fact, before we named the company. And I got such a kick out of it. And such an interest in the tonal qualities of wood, as well as all the aspects that go into it, the bearing edges and the finish and the hardware. So, you know, one thing progressed to another, and then we designed our own hardware components, the Lux and the DS1 strainer, and those all get done here in Carlsbad, California. So that's what it was. It was more of a, you know, keep yourself busy, which turned from a hobby into this little business.
Right. Now, why do you focus on solid and stave drums and not plywood?
Well, when I started doing the research into drums, you know, from the Leedys and the early Ludwigs and things like that, and as well as Radio Kings, there was a strong emphasis on the solid wood and the performance of solid wood drum back in those days. And then that picked up pace when Craviato came back in and started doing it. And so as I was experimenting with different drums, I tried some of Dunnett stuff and some of Craviato stuff, as well as DW and a lot of ply companies. And I just found the sound to be richer and in many cases more resonant in the solid wood drums. And mm-hmm. and I find that both in stave and in steam vent. Mm-hmm. They do perform differently. I think probably more resonant possibly in some of the stave designs and a more focused round kind of note, if you will, on the steam vent side.
Mm. Have you ever made a plywood drum at all, or did you go straight to solid?
Yes, I have made a few. You know, they were fine. They just didn't seem to have the same tonal qualities and depth of sound that I was getting out of the solid wood. So after, you know, a handful of attempts, I just started focusing solely on the solid wood.
Now, how do you go about developing and then introducing a new line or style of drum?
Well, that gets into the research, like looking into the Radio Kings of the old days and the Ludwigs of the 20s. My focus has been on trying to recreate some of those sounds. And so that led to the development of the Classic Collection, which is our take on the Ludwig super sensitive or the Ludwig drums of the 1920s, which were steam vent. And the legend was a take on the Radio King and using the exact bearing edges, because we were able to have an exact Radio King and one of those Ludwigs. And with computer, we can actually replicate those almost perfectly. Once again, steam vent on both of those sides. And so that has been a very popular sound profile, both those types of sounds, the Ludwig sound and the Radio King sound with the really rounded bearing edges, 30 degree round over. So that has led to my interest in, we're actually going to introduce the Legend Series kits and Classic Collection kits, which will be coming out in the next 3 weeks. What we're doing on that, the very first one on the Legend Series will be European Beach, and it'll have the 30 degree round overs. It'll have a separate distinct lug design for it. And then the Classic Collection, the very first one coming out, will be Maple. And it'll be in that Pacific Pearl finish that you've seen. Mm-hmm. It's our take on the Peacock Pearl of the 1920s. And we'll have the long tube lugs that were customly built back in those days. So long brass tube lugs that are chrome plated and the 45 degree special round over bearing edges. Both on the take of the Classic and the Legend Series. The other line that we've done is the Pure. And the Pure sound, the Pure shell, I should say, is our attempt at building a shell with the least amount of drilling or glue. So it doesn't have to have glue re-rings. They're actually milled. So we have the milling capability now to take 5/8 of an inch thick board and mill the middle of the body out, and leaving the bearing edges thicker, which gives it, obviously, rigidity, keeps it in round, but allows us to eliminate any gluing other than the scarf joint. And we've made it an 8-lug design because it's 8-lug single point. So it has the least amount of drilling, the least amount of glue, and it is by far the most resonant shell we make. So it was, once again, it was experimenting sound and trying to eliminate weight and eliminate unnecessary glue to see what we could come up with, and we're pleased with the results.
Now, how did you settle on the types of wood that you use for those drums, the Pure series?
Well, on the steam bent side, we in the steam bending world, there's certain species of domestic species that work and certain that don't. And so we've been focused on maple and walnut, which are clearly, they're good for steam bending purposes. And we think good tonally, kind of match what was going on back in those days. We've added ash, European beech, and oak, all are, which are good at bending and all have their own distinct voice. And we just actually finished our first few European beech. I think they sound great. I'm really looking forward to the full kit in the 30-degree round over, you know, seeing how, what kind of voice that produces for us. So most of it on the steam bend side has to do with the species' ability to take the pressure of bending. And then on the stave side, it's limitless. And so on this, and we also do, as you know, we're now on the exotic side, we're doing East Indian rosewood, which we think is an exceptional tonal wood, and Tasmanian blackwood from Australia, which is an acacia, and it bends well. So those will continue to do on the exotic side for snares. And on the stave side, we've looked at all kinds of different rosewoods and very dense woods to give us some really crisp sound. As a matter of fact, I just finished one today made out of Paul Rosa, which is a very dense hardwood from Africa. I'll send you a pic later, but exceptionally bright, very sensitive, very much in line with the density of a rosewood. So you kind of give it a sense of what kind of sound it produce. But we're always looking at, on the stave side, at the tonal woods that have been used in musical instruments, whether they're mandolins. We just finished a Spanish cedar snare drum, which is very, Spanish cedar is used in building those, some of the higher end ones. And so we like looking at and experimenting with woods that in other musical applications seem to perform well tonally. And so with very little limitations on what you can do with it, because basically you're cutting 20 staves for a snare drum and they're each 2 3/8 inch thick. And so you can pretty much get it out of almost any wood and eliminate knots and all the other imperfections.
Was there any wood that you thought was going to sound great that just doesn't?
Trying to think of some of the stinkers. you know, I can't think of anything that was really just terrible. You know, I've built out of so many different woods. None of them had a really bad sound. Some of them had a, for example, poplar. It had a much deeper, lower register than you can imagine. And then some of the ashes and others, in some people's, for their sound profile, may be a little too aggressive, too harsh. But I haven't found any that I just went, oh my God, I got to burn this as fancy, you know, firewood. So I haven't done that.
What about the flip side? Any that really surprised you?
Yeah, some that are, that really surprised me and it was difficult to accomplish was East Indian rosewood. I just think it has such a beautiful sound. Really like the Tasmanian blackwood. What I find in the domestic side, we do myrtle, which I think very few companies have ever used. It's a domestic from Northwest. Great tonal wood. It's used in a lot of high-end acoustic guitars. I really found that to be quite excellent. And I'm really a fan of walnut. I just like the warmth and the roundness, and it's such a warm, beautiful sound to me. And then I think the last one that really does sound great, and I wasn't sure it was going to make a good drum, was Spanish cedar, because it's so lightweight and it has very little density, but it has such a warm, deep sound to it, and the shell's a half an inch thick. So that was one that it was an experiment to see, you know, because people have asked me about cedar drums, and I just thought, well, I put lugs on it, I don't know. Not sure it's going to stay together, you know?
Right.
But at half an inch thick, it does, and it sounds really good. The drum, the shell itself weighs like as much of as a newspaper. It's very lightweight.
That's
so
good.
The only thing of mass on it are the hoops and the lugs.
That's good to know. Good for the gigging drummer for sure.
Yeah.
Before we dive into the two new drums, can you describe the difference, what you hear sonically between the classic and the legend? Like, what are the sound profiles that you would describe?
Yeah, I think you hear a much fatter, deeper sound with less sustain in the legend. I mean, in the legend.
Okay.
And that's because of the rounded nature of a heavily, heavily rounded 30-degree bearing edge, which were used in the 30s and 40s. So you have less sustain, a lot of depth to the sound, and I think you get a much brighter sound, a little bit more attack, and a little more sensitivity on the classic because the 45, it's a 45 round of it, but once again, it's a much sharper edge. So you're going to get more sustain, more ringing, you know, much more open tone. So one is kind of a closed tone, warm, very Gene Krupa kind of sound, you know, on the legend side. And the other is a much more bright, articulate, and a lot more overtones and overringing, which would be, you know, in any kind of sharp bearing edge.
All right, so let's talk about the two drums that you sent for me to check out recently. This is the East Indian Rosewood, which is a 6.5x14, and then a Tasmanian Blackwood, which is a 5.5x14. Everything about the shell is otherwise similar, right? 45 degree with round over edge, eight lugs. And I thought they played very well together. I thought they were, if you would have asked me to guess what the woods were, I would have thought they were the same. I don't know if you have the similar thoughts about the sound profile.
You got stuck there for a minute. You were frozen. So, did you repeat that question?
Yeah, so the sound profile of these two drums, I heard them playing very well together, almost to the point where I would have guessed they were the same species. I wouldn't have guessed they were two different species. Was that the intention, to have these similar exotic woods, or you hear these things very differently?
I hear them differently, and I think it would probably come down to having them, you know, the same depth and everything like that. Because the acacia is significantly less dense than the rosewood, significantly. And so if you were doing, you know, the same logs on it and the same bearing edges and the same depth, I think you would definitely hear a difference because of the softer nature of the blackwood will make it warmer, a little deeper, whereas the density of East Indian rosewood is considerably more dense than the blackwood. And you're going to get, I think, higher, more volume out of highs and mids with some good sensitive lows, where the blackwood is going to tend to be more low and mid and very little on the high because, once again, of the density of the wood.
Yeah, so maybe what you said was the depth is what might bounce them out to my ear. Like the deeper rosewood sounds a little bit bigger, and then the shallower blackwood sounds a little bit brighter than maybe they would be compared side by side.
Yeah, I definitely think that is the case.
Yeah,
and that was the very first one we built, and we've got four more in production of different sizes on the blackwood side. We're really happy with the sound that came out of both of those species.
Yeah, I'm still yet to make a decision on which one I like better. They both kind of, you guys, every drum of yours that I play seems to be a perfect balance of everything in certain ways. Like I get the open brightness of a metal shell, but also the warmth and depth of a wood shell. And honestly, these two drums I thought were like the finest representations of that you've put out there so far.
I would agree with you. Balanced. I think depending on the heads you use and how tight you tune the drum up or down, you're going to get a really nice kind of metallic feel out of the rosewood. I mean, it almost has a little bit of a metallic sound to it because it's so dense. But then it doesn't, you know, then the bottom end still has, in my opinion, has the woody sound to it. Yep. So you get that kind of tingy, bingy, whatever you want to call it, you know, kind of the metallic start and then a wood finish, I think is the way I kind of describe it.
Yeah, they're beautiful. So you kind of already answered my last question. Like, what's next? You're doing classic series kits, legend series kits.
Absolutely.
Is there going to be a pure series kit down the road?
That is probably not something we're not exploring right now.
Okay.
It's because the technique used to manufacture it doesn't lend itself to going to smaller than 14 inches.
Oh, okay.
We can do 13, but if you wanted to do a 12, 14, 22, that process would be very difficult on the pure size. So we're staying with 13 and 14 at this point. Although, you know, when we get bored, we'll experiment and you may end up seeing a bass drum, you know?
Awesome. Well, I can't wait to check out the kits when they're ready. But in the meantime, in this episode, we are highlighting the, how do you pronounce it? Vishuddha?
Yeah.
East Indian rosewood. And the TB1, which is Tasmanian Blackwood Solid Shell Snare. We're going to drop an audio here later in the episode, but that's all the questions I had for you today. Appreciate it.
Excellent.
All right, let's get to the demo. So the first one is the 5.5x14 8 lug Tasmanian Blackwood Solid Shell Drum. They're calling the TB1. Tasmanian Blackwood is a pretty hard timber. It's 1160 on the Jenker rating. This has 45 degree round bearing edges, chrome plated solid brass tube lugs, the proprietary Doc Sweeney throw off, which I call the DS1. This has an Evans UV1 batter, Evans 300 snare side, and I'm going to take it through the full tuning range. So check it out. Here is the TB1 by Doc Sweeney.
All right, and we're going to finish up with the Vishuddha drum. This is a 6.5 by 14.8 lug East Indian rosewood solid shell snare. This has a throat chakra etched into the shell that's very cool looking. This is a very hard shell. It is 2440 on the Janka hardness rating. It has 45-degree round bearing edges, aluminum arch lugs, the DS1 strainer. This one came with a Remo Diplomat fiber skin batter and an Ambassador Hazy, which was a great combo. I feel it just rounded out the dense hardwood a little bit, made it sound very, very musical and rich. So yeah, these are two gorgeous, gorgeous drums. Check out the Vishuddha. Check out the TB1. Go to their website, Doc Sweeney Drums. Check out more of what they got. This is some of the finest craftsmanship you'll find. So here we go. This is the Vishuddha. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you, everybody, for watching this week's Modern Drummer Podcast. Stay tuned for next week's episode exclusively on Podcast One. Until then, stay safe and healthy, and thanks for listening and watching.